Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to Sparkwood in 21. And tonight, we are going to talk about Judy. This is the No Ship Network podcast. I'm your host, Steve.
I'm your host, Paul.
And I am your host, Em.
If you like what you hear, head on over to noship.net where you can find all of the other podcasts we do. If you like horror, we have Penny Dreadful and Ash vs. Evil Dead. If you like historical, we've got Vikings and Spartacus. And if you're anything like us, we have All Flesh and American Gods. Contact us through Gmail and leave a review on iTunes. Also, check out the TV Time app. It lets you keep track of all your favorite shows, as well as participate in a community of like-minded fans.
We want to thank everybody who has taken the time to write us reviews on iTunes. If you haven't done so yet, please head over to iTunes and write us a review. You will get a chance to win a double R coffee cup from Paul that he has made by hand. And I will share again the image of that coffee cup with the post of this podcast on our Twitter and on our Facebook page. Also, Paul has an eBay auction where he's selling a Twin Peaks inspired mug as a way to raise funds to help pay for No Ship Network costs. So if you're interested, we also have a link to that on our Twitter page, and I will share it in the show notes for this podcast as well. All right, so we are discussing Twin Peaks The Return, Part 15, also known as There's Some Fear in Letting Go. This was directed by David Lynch, and it's written by Mark Frost and David Lynch. So we open up in Twin Peaks with Nadine marching with the golden shovel hoisted over her shoulder. And we soon see that she's heading towards Big Ed's gas farm, and she walks up to him to tell him that she has changed, that she realizes she's been manipulative and jealous, and she doesn't want to keep Norma and Ed apart any longer. In fact, it will make her happy thinking of them happy together. And she also says that he could thank Dr. Amp, who is the only one telling it like it is.
So at least we finally got some good coming from Dr. Amp's rantings and ravings and the selling of gold shovels. I like how she just comes right out. She's like, no, I've been a selfish bitch. She's just laying it on. It's a good scene in the sense that it's letting you know. It's fan service in a way, because we all have wanted to see this for so long. And right after this scene and then the next scene is over with and it turns to black and white, I was like, oh, man, they're going to make us pay for that. They give us something that we want, and then we're going to have to pay for the rest of the episode.
I know.
But it wasn't bad like that. It was just everything took a darker turn and stayed that way. But it was great to see something happen that you feel like this character has been deserving for better than 25 years.
Yeah. I like how he tells her, are you sure about this? And she's like, you know, I've walked all the way here. I've had plenty of time to turn around. This isn't one of my episodes type thing. I want you to do this. It was really touching. It was nice.
Yeah, it does seem like benevolence coming from the great gods of Twin Peaks, Frost and Lynch. And I do wonder if there's more to come.
That just means that there's more heartache and pain coming down the road.
So now at the double R, we've got Otis Redding. I've been loving you. Ed walks in, just revved up by this news from Nadine, and he has a very robust hello. He tells her that everything has changed. Nadine has given me my freedom. And on rewatch, you could tell she's excited by this news, by the look in her eyes, but she doesn't actually say anything in that way. She says, I'm so sorry. Walter is here.
And you're kind of expecting it in typical Twin Peaks fashion to be like, all right, this good thing is going to happen. And then the brakes get put on and it's like, nope, it's another missed opportunity, especially with these two characters, because you feel like it's a perpetual thing. Like they're never, ever going to get together. So there was part of you who was expecting that. And then when you see Walter, you're like, oh, okay, there's the cock block right there. So
Ed is reeling from this, what seems to be a rejection, and sits down at the counter and orders himself a cup of coffee from Shelley. And quietly he orders a side of cyanide.
Oh. He waits till she walks out of earshot and he's like, in a cyanide tablet. It's like, oh, man.
So now we have a scene where we cut to Norma and Walter, and she wants Walter to buy her out. And we do have a moment where we see Ed, and he's calming his heart and mind, I think, after this rejection. But, you know, back to Norma and Walter, she wants to keep her diner. She wants to go ahead and take the option to where he buys out the other ones. And she's saying she wants to help her family. And he makes a comment about how he thought she didn't have a family, which I thought was like a really psychopathic thing to say. I don't want to say he's a psychopath, but the fact that he remembered she didn't have family, it's almost like he's this predator that like searches out that lone animal that's easier to tackle, that doesn't have its herd around it or something. That's how I view him.
Right.
I that hadn't even crossed my mind, mm-hmm. except for the fact that, you know, it fits with the whole him being dirty like Hank Jennings kind of thing. Like, this guy is a more successful Hank Jennings sort, but it makes perfect sense now that you say it, because it's like, why would you remember that about somebody? Like, out of all the conversations that they've probably had, he remembers that one little fact. Of course, there could be more to his personality. He might remember a lot of other things too. Being a businessman, but
at the beginning of the conversation, he says, "Did you get my flowers?" So he's been trying to pursue her at the same time. So he's gonna know whether or not if she has an immediate family, just because he's trying to court her in an old fashioned kind of way. You know what I mean? Like, here, I've sent you flowers. I'm your business partner, but you know, I'm trying to make my way in. Because he does. He looks like he's kind of fawning over. That's why when she buys him out and he's realizing it's kind of falling out around him, he's like, oh, well, this is a poor move, because she's essentially kind of breaking up with him. Like, I don't need you around here.
Yeah. Anymore. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It could be what you're describing about he could be trying to pursue her mm-hmm. romantically, but he doesn't seem attracted to her. Like, I don't get that vibe off of him towards her. Mm. So, if there is anything, I think it's still predatory, or it's also that whole business relationship, like, where I'll see with my boss where other businesses will try to curry favor by sending, I mean, during holidays, we get all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, that's true.
And if he was trying to court her, like, really hardcore, you would think, at least, because I felt that way too with the flowers, and he did take her out for dinner in the last scene.
Yeah, the body language, he put his hands on hers. I mean, so it felt that way.
It does seem like that, but then you have, I think back to that other scene, and Ed is sitting at the table with her, and he gets up and leaves, and he's like, who is that? And she's like, Ed mm-hmm. Hurley, you know, like, I've told you about him before. He should be aware that that's his chief rival for her affections, if that's the case. But so it seems weird that he wouldn't remember Ed's name, but it stuck in his mind that she didn't have a family. Well, so that goes back to the creepiness.
Yeah, that's
level
true.
Of it.
But like you got to think too that this is a businessman also. So, you know, he didn't say he was like a pompous ass, you know, on his own right.
Yeah.
You know, and it made me feel like if he hadn't come in and said, look, about what was happening with him and Nadine, that she would have kept the diners and pursued this option possibly. But because of the news, she was like, ready, okay, I don't want to do this anymore. Go.
Like, she was teetering in her mind.
Mm-hmm. It did a little bit.
I don't like that, because I would rather Norma decide that on her own. I took it as that after their previous conversation, she was having misgivings about his suggestions towards how she should change her recipe or buy the cheaper ingredients for her pie. And I think she's been thinking about it since then. And I would like to think that she chose to make this decision for her own interests, not because her love interest just was now available in her life.
Well, no, I think all those things added up. It's just, you know, I feel for Norma as much as him, because she's been dangling this whole time, you know, not being able to love the person she loves. So I think maybe she's been in other relationships to where it was like never ever pursuing anything. And I agree. I think definitely the pie was a big deal. You know, the way that he's been handling business is huge. I think it was just maybe the last little push that pushed her over the edge, you know? Not that she wasn't going to do it, but maybe it was that last push of, okay, I can speed things up a little more because I don't like the way you're running my business. I don't like the way you're pushing me to change my name of the one here. And then now I can finally take care of, and she says family, which I meant, you know, it was him at the bar. So it felt like the last piece of the puzzle for her. Like, okay, I can finally put that last piece in the middle.
Yeah, like she was kind of teetering on the edge, and then that tips her over, like, oh,
exactly.
Ed's free? Okay, I can definitely do this. Yeah. I might have done it anyway because this guy's pissing me off with his, you know, the way he's handling it. Like, oh, well, if you read the fine print bullshit, and then she could do it. But I thought it was cool that when he said, well, you said you didn't have a family. She's like, no, I have a very nice family, and I want to spend more time with them, and I want to take care of them. And I think she's directly talking about Ed now and Shelley and Becky and the people the regulars who come to the diner all the time. And, you know, and there's Toad. to be reckoned with as well. You know, he's in there. So like everybody who comes in, and the diner itself, that's like part of her family too. So she wants to take care of all that. So
I think she's probably felt a little bit hamstrung probably by her books that she's back there always keeping, which I think is due to all these other businesses that she's having to manage or account for. And where she's watching Shelly deal with her daughter and try to just pull out ones and whatever cash she has. And she's having this conversation with Shelly that, you know, we need to do something else. It's just going to get worse and worse. She's going to ask for more and more money. So I think maybe we could see Norma funding for rehab or something like that for Becky.
Or that could be her intent. But Becky might not be around, but we'll get to
later.
Oh, who knows what's going on with Dirty Steve, you know? What's he upset about? So,
So I know we've talked about this scene already quite a bit for as short as it was with Walter and Norma, but I just want to say one more thing about it. I think it's a good sign for Twin Peaks because I think Norma with the outside influence coming in to the double R, this is a turnaround. Mm-hmm. With her pushing Walter back out. And I did notice with Ed that Napa Auto Parts was right next door to his gas farm. I don't know if that would be a competitor.
Oh, for sure.
But those businesses tend to open up right next to them and try to, you know,
squeeze them out,
compete with them in a very hostile way.
Well, Ed's place was I don't think he was a sales shop. I think he was a repair shop. So that would actually be a symbiotic relationship, probably.
Okay. Because I don't really
then
know
he
much
could
about
go to the store. Because if you have the mechanic, then you have the parts dealership. Because they're sending people on trucks all the time over to like, hey, because they have the relationships between them. Because it's,
I guess, as long as he can get it at cost from them.
Yeah, there has to be a deal.
Yeah. I did notice that he only takes cash.
I noticed that on the moving reflection cup of soup scene. He says like strictly cash only. You could see that one in the background, which I think is crazy in 2017. You know, I understand why people don't take checks, but you're not even taking like debit or credit.
Right.
I mean, that's pretty, maybe not so much in Twin Peaks, but it's pretty limiting, I would imagine. How many people have enough cash sitting on them to actually pay for a car repair?
Yeah.
Most people don't even carry enough cash around to fill up their tank of gas.
Yeah, I use my card for everything, right?
They got to swipe it, swipe, swipe, swipe.
Which Ed's like this embodiment of resilience in a way. I mean, even with him sticking it out with Nadine, it symbolizes that to me. Mm-hmm. And I think he represents the resilience of Twin Peaks. So there is hope that Twin Peaks can survive all of this.
Fingers crossed. Fingers crossed.
So now we're to the part that we all been waiting for. Finally, Ed's grimly sitting at the counter thinking the worst, and Norma comes up and she slides her hands onto his shoulder and they embrace, and Ed whispers, "Marry me." She says, "Of course I will." And Shelley watches tearfully, and Otis Redding just soars up into the sky. Not him physically, obviously, the music. And we've got this beautiful blue sky with nice fluffy white clouds. It all seems so happy. But at the same time, when it's in this context, you just know it's not going to last.
Nope.
Well, at least, do you mean that the feeling that we're getting is not going to last, or them two aren't going to last?
The feeling.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was talking about earlier. I agree 100% because I was like, oh no, they're going to make us pay for this. And then what do you see next is black and white nighttime crackling electricity along the power lines.
Yeah, and it's like this weirdly dark sky where you just have smog to level 100% and blanketing the entire place. Yeah, and then electricity, as Steve described, is traveling these utility wires. And now we're seeing night driving. And this is, to me now, Mr. C's calling card. Anytime you see that, you know you're going to see him next. And he pulls right up to the convenience store, the one that was from episode 8, part 8.
The convenience store. Actually, the convenience store looks like it's existing in two different places, or at least going to be ceasing to exist in our place.
Yeah, it's a TARDIS. At any rate.
It is like
the TARDIS. Yeah.
That's what I thought of. I was like, ooh, evil TARDIS.
It's a noisier TARDIS. Like, smokier. It sounds like it's going to be, smokier and noisier.
And it's even bigger on the inside than it looks.
Right. It's crazy.
And it's dirtier on the inside than it is on the outside.
So Mr. C is escorted up the staircase by a woodsman, and he enters a hidden space dimension. Before he enters the room, you actually see some woods first, and then you see the rose wallpaper. And there is a woodsman that's seated next to this. It looks like a gutted old radio, I think. I'm not sure what it was.
I couldn't tell either, but there were some things that looked like tubes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Like you would find like in an old-style radio.
Yeah.
And he's got some sort of blood or dark substance seeping from his mouth onto his shirt. I don't know if we're supposed to link him to the missing Billy because of that, the guy in the jail cell, because of the stuff coming out of his mouth.
Yeah, it does provide a link to that visually. At least. Mm-hmm. But you can't, with it being so dark, you can't really tell what the substance is. It could be blood. It could be motor oil. It could just be, it could be anything else, really. But then again, the guy in the cell that we're assuming is Billy, it doesn't really look just like straight up blood. It looks like a blood with a mixture of other stuff. Mm-hmm. So
this woodsman that's seated next to this possible radio, he pushes down a lever and electricity pops, and we see the jumping man from Fire Walk With Me. I try to pause this myself because I got wind of this on the internet that there's a face superimposed over this. It was really hard to see. I think there's more than one face, more than a few faces.
Oh,
and
wow.
Which is generating ideas for me because I believe this is the same jumping man who had the mask that opens up the mask and says Judy as the monkey face in Fire Walk With Me. Am I right about that?
I think you are. Yeah.
And we want to know who the dreamer is. So possibly it's Judy. Well, who is Judy? Well, if Judy's this multi-faced being, maybe it's multiple people who are dreaming. Maybe it's the entire town of Twin Peaks.
Yeah, wow.
Because they've been all infested by frog bugs.
Shit.
That's my new going theory. I mean, we had to be shown the woodsman and those frog bugs for a reason, where you had the whole town, like just in 1956, where those woodsmen ended up, everybody was just falling over hearing that radio station.
That's true.
So maybe this has happened before in another town. So this is something that's happening
in Twin Peaks.
In Twin Peaks. But I thought I could see, I was like, is that Cooper's face? Is that Dick Tremaine's face? Is that Sarah Palmer's face? Like, I kept seeing all these possible faces.
But I was waiting for Captain Howdy to show up. Just to flash on there real quick, the Exorcist face from the dream. But no dice. But yeah, I couldn't make out any, like, say, like, oh, that's this person or that's that person. But it's definitely transforming into other faces, sometimes with discernible features, sometimes not. But the closed captioning of that scene says high-pitched rewinding sound.
Yeah, that's weird.
So I don't know if that's the closest approximation they could get to with that, or if that was in the materials that mm-hmm. they got from the Twin Peaks people to say, okay, this is what you need to call that. And if it is, why? What rewinding? What's going on? That just opens up a whole nother can of worms.
So now we have another woodsman at the threshold, where there's a doorway right next to the seated one that has the seeping mouth. And the one with the seeping mouth thumps his walking stick. And this is when the one that's at the doorway gestures towards Mr. C to follow. Like, that was the signal he needed.
Yeah, that put him into motion. It's like he was dormant up until that point.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, all right, get to work, bud.
So they walk this dark, long hallway towards the room with a staircase that Gordon Cole had saw in the vortex. But before they get to that room, it's dark at first. And then they're in this like insubstantial wooded area. And it's made me go, has he traveled? I mean, if he were to like exit like a doorway up mm-hmm. here, would he be in a completely different state or even country or something like that? And it also made me wonder, is this ghostwood? And is this why it's ghostwood? Because you've got like things traveling through like that.
Hmm.
Now up the stairs, which is the same stairs that Gordon Cole saw, because you can even see that white stain. He enters a room and he finds himself in an outdoor courtyard. And the wallpaper at this point, which is that rose wallpaper mm-hmm. that we've seen in One Eye Jack's, and we've also seen in the painting that Laura had in Fire Walk With Me. As he gets closer to the courtyard, before he enters the courtyard, it's actually gotten blackened. Mm-hmm. Like, you could still see some of the wallpaper showing through. Maybe soot has covered it because mm-hmm. of fire or something like that. But he enters this courtyard, which would now put him at ground level, even though he just walked up some stairs.
Right.
Well, this is, I think they took a shortcut through dimensions to get there. So that's my impression of what it was. And any of these dimensions were probably, they looked like they were all still, if you exited at any point, you'd still be on Earth, but it was trans-dimensional travel, like just using the dimensions to get from point A to point B without having to actually travel that distance. Who knows how long it could be. So you could go from somewhere in South Dakota or Montana, I guess, as it were, that was the last place that we saw him. And so he could be like in northern Idaho. He could be in like eastern Washington State or whatever, heading this way. But this looks like I have no idea where this courtyard is. It's a shitty little motel somewhere. But
is this the Dutchman's?
It's got to be, right?
I'm not sure that the reference of the Dutchman wasn't referring to above the convenience store, because that's where he said, he goes, I know what that is. And that's how you have to get to Philip Jeffries. He technically wasn't hanging out there because that was where you had to go first. That was your starting point, but he had to get there. So maybe that's what that, or maybe the hotel, like the little motel or whatever it is the Dutchman. I don't know.
So Mr. C walks across the courtyard and he approaches a door and he's unable to open it because it is locked. A woman comes up and says in lodge speak that she can open the door for or unlock the door for him. She's very disconcerting looking.
Yeah.
In the credits, I believe she's the bosomy woman.
Yeah, she is.
Really? The bosomy woman?
The bosomy
Unless
woman.
That's talking about a different character.
No, I think that was the only one that it really applied to.
That poor lady, because one day she's going to go for another job. She's like, I was in Twin Peaks. I was the bosomy woman. Damn it.
We don't have any bosomy parts for this show, so.
Nobody's ever said that. So now Mr. C is in the room and it's this greasy looking room, and maybe it's just all steamy in there, but you have this very like ineffective lamp and a flickering fluorescent, yellowy fluorescent light above. You see this like sort of vaguely wood paneled wall, but it's so dark it's hard to really make it out, but it's like a partition moves. And then now you've got this giant teapot, which is an evolved Philip Jeffries.
Well, so I think the fireman sucked him up in it with that thing of his and squirted him in the teapot, right?
It's like recast Philip Jeffries inside of a giant bell or whatever those things are, his alarm system.
Maybe he died and they saved his essence, because it has the steam coming out of it. It made me think of the pine cone rose thing that Andy had, you know? So, I mean... It's definitely different, and it's a different way to approach, you know, somebody who's passed away and to still have that character in the show. I'll give it to him. Nobody else but Lynch and them would come up with the giant teapot, you know. So it was surprising but effective.
It reminded me a lot, and I think it was supposed to, of certain scenes from Eraserhead, and then it also the stuff that Cooper was going through at the very beginning of the return, when he was going through the different phases of everything.
Yeah.
A lot of the way that teapot is built and the otherworldliness of it and stuff like that, you could almost see that thing floating around in space somewhere by itself.
That's a good point.
Like this is the Philip Jeffries satellite. You know, you go inside it.
Mr. C says how he remembers Philip Jeffries, and he alludes to the time of 1989 when Philip showed up at the FBI headquarters in Philadelphia. And this causes Philip Jeffries to say, "So you are Cooper."
We know that Annie shows up in Laura's dream, or right after it, however you want to look at it, and says, "The good Cooper, the good Dale Cooper, is stuck in the lodge." We know that Mr. C is out in the world with black eyes, being evil as fuck, but using all of the self-control and smarts that Dale Cooper had.
Yeah.
We knew that he was going to get pulled back into the lodge. The fireman told the Cooper, who we suspect is the real one, that it's time for you to go, but that one has to come back in before you can fully do the thing. Then we have the Dougie Coop, who was a construct who dies, goes back into the lodge, and then we all know what happens because we all saw it, and he was able to stay out. I think so. I don't think this is the actual Cooper. I think that Philip Jeffries is unable to tell whether or not this is the actual Cooper because it looks like Cooper, it smells like Cooper, it sounds like Cooper.
Okay, but he was able to say that he was a fraud back in 1989 in Philadelphia at FBI headquarters. He was, who do you think this is right here? But now he's acknowledging this one as the Cooper.
Well, maybe he, because he had a body, he could tell now that he's in the teapot, he's got distorted.
He has no eyeballs.
Yeah.
Well, he can't tell for sure. He says, so you are Cooper. He doesn't, it's not a declarative statement. It's more of a question. Like there's still doubt because he's, true. You know, because he says, okay, you sent Ray to kill me. And he's like, I don't have your number. And he's just like, then he goes, we used to talk. Yeah. And then he says, yeah, back in Philadelphia in 1989. Now, we used to talk would be misleading because they didn't know each other at that point. Because he said, Coop, meet Philip Jeffries, the long-lost Philip Jeffries, right?
Yeah.
So they hadn't known each other before that time, unless you want to get into a whole bunch of time theory to where whatever happened previous to that, that they, who knows.
Happening after.
Yeah, is this the past or is it the present? And but anyway, so at this point, all we really know is that his allusion to we used to talk is 1989, and now here we are in 2017 or whatever year it is in Twin Peaks, and he's saying, so you are the Cooper. And he doesn't confirm it or deny it because he can't say, yes, I'm Dale Cooper, you know. And this is actually the second time in this one episode that he's been mistaken for Dale Cooper, which is a good thing because it means it's coming right up to the point where we're going to get the real Cooper. And after the stuff with Dougie, I think it's become pretty apparent. But
maybe he was saying it like this, like, okay, we've talked once back then and I knew it was not the actual Cooper, right? So maybe he's just kind of testing him to see how much he does know because it's the first time he's actually had a conversation with him. So he's saying you are Cooper and the fact that you are made of Cooper and have his memories. Yeah.
Like you have the essence of him in there somewhere.
Exactly.
Because so he's amazed by this doppelganger creation in that way to where it's that exact as far as like the replication.
Exactly. Like you are Cooper.
It's not just the physical. It's also the memory.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Because really, for all intents and purposes, if the other Cooper is still either trapped in Dougie or supposedly in the lodge, whichever one it's actually going to be, this is the Cooper who exists on the mortal plane right now. He is the one and only until, you know, the good side of, and really being doppelgangers, you're just two parts of the same whole. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like when John Crichton got divided in Farscape. There was two of them, but neither one of them was the real one. They were both real. So
nice.
You know, it maybe that's what it is too.
But one wasn't the shadow of the other like we have here.
Yeah, yeah. So it's different. It's different in its own way.
We'll move on. So he's asking, who is Judy? What does she want with me? And then Philip Jeffries says, let me write it down for you. And he forms these numbers that comes out of his steam. And it's hilarious because I think some of them have exponents. And one of them even has the exponent of one. So it's like pointless. Really? 5 to the power of 1? Unless I read it wrong. I swear to God it said that.
Well, Mr. C is hot on the trail because he's pulling out his little pen and notebook as fast as he can to write it down. You know,
I was shocked he had a pen and paper.
8675309.
Well, are exponents used for something else that I'm not aware of? Like, as far as, can they be used to express something beyond just how you would multiply them?
Look, as Dirty Steve would say, I'm a high school graduate, not a college graduate. So you're going to have to answer that one for me.
Right.
Well, maybe somebody smarter than us will write in and let us know. All right. And Mr. C presses the issue. Who is Judy? And Mr. Jeffrey says, you've already met Judy. Mr. C wants an answer and he's demanding it. And Jeffrey starts to kind of like fade out and the phone begins to ring. And I think this is kind of a psych out because it's like, well, what do you do with a phone when it rings? You answer it. So I think Mr. C thinks he's going to get the answer to his question, but instead it's Jeffrey's way of booting him
out. Kick his ass out. Time's up.
Yep.
Stupid humans can't resist a ringing phone.
So who is Judy?
But Judy has a phone number.
Yeah, yep. You can. I guess.
Fuck.
So, well, I don't know. Okay, so
who has he met?
He has this number. Look, it's Diane. Okay.
Oh, I was because say that, jerk.
It's Diane, and the reason why
it's Diane is because
we know she gets a text that says Las Vegas with a question mark. He writes down a number that Jeffries tells him. He goes out after he deals with Richard Horn. He flips his phone up. He's like, "Hey, get in the car, kid." You know, and he flips his phone and he starts dialing in a text, and it says Las Vegas, and then he sends it. That doesn't hold as much water as I'd like it to, because he's already been texting with this other person ostensibly, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it all of a sudden, you know, he's using the new number and texting it. Probably not likely. Right. But I foresee a scene whenever Janie E sees Diane and she goes, "Judy, you bitch," you know, and then we know for sure because they hate each other.
Diane's doppelganger, Judy.
Well, Diane's doppelganger would be nice. You know, she would just be nice to everybody. Hey, how are you doing?
What if she's nice in a mean way? So it's backwards, though.
Ooh.
I don't know. I have no idea who the fuck Judy is. It's a pet.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I'm going to need more input before I can. More information.
How many episodes
I think it's one
left?
Of those things. It's a. We have one single episode, and then we have the last two will be played back to back. So there's only actually two more weeks of Twin Peaks at this point, even though we have three more hours. So
and it's like, is Judy a bad person or a good person? So are you dropping a major villain on us? I have no idea. I have no theories on this. I honestly have no idea. I'm hoping our listeners can come up with something fantastic for the feedback.
I have no doubt they will.
Right?
But I feel like this has dropped on us at a late stage, the idea that he knows who Judy is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to set all of our heads spinning. But the answer to it is not going to be something that we can come up with.
That it's like a conglomerate of people, like Twin Peaks. That would be amazing. You know, like Judy meant something like, you know, J-U-D-Y.
And what if it's beyond that? What if all those people are actually made up by one person, like Laura or something? Maybe it's Laura.
What if Judy is an acronym for just understand this, y'all? And that's... I think seriously though, I think that's what it is. We have this piece of information that at the very least Philip Jeffries believes that Mr. C knows who she is, but that could mean that Cooper knows too, right? Mm-hmm. Unless this is somebody who he's assuming that he's met since he's who knows. But it's not something that we the audience is going to be able to figure out. I don't think it's something that we're gonna like just chase our tails for another 2 weeks until we find out the answer.
Yeah,
and after we find out the answer.
After seeing old Phil, I don't think he's the millionaire anymore, just because it'd be hard to do business in a teapot.
Yeah. So. And he didn't. There's somebody else out there, I believe, because he didn't definitively answer the question of, did you call me 5 days ago?
Exactly.
And the person who was on the other end of the line was a lot more forceful, a lot more direct, and very less cryptic about what they...
Unless the teapot was a communications tool and he was in another location and was sending all the information through steam like a telephone.
Huh.
Because the fireman uses steam in different ways, so maybe the steam is his way. Because he's not electric, he's using steam. I don't know. Or smoke.
Huh.
So now, even though it seemed like Mr. C traveled... He's now booted out right where he entered the convenience store. And Richard Horn is there holding Mr. C at gunpoint briefly. But before he gets his ass kicked by Mr. C, we learn that Audrey is definitely Richard Horn's mother and that he recognized Mr. C when he saw him at that thug farm because he has seen a pic of the FBI agent Cooper before because his mother had it.
Thug farm. I like that. That's nice.
It's appropriate.
So you feel like this is definitive proof that that's his dad?
No, definitive.
Proof
but
that
closer.
It's his, that Audrey's his mom for sure. But
right.
The way that Mr. C kind of goes, "Who's your mom?" And then he's like, "Get in the car." Anybody else, I think he might have killed.
Yeah, I think this could be because of the memories Cooper has that makes him more likely to, maybe that's why he's, I don't know. He's not a friendly guy, so it's like hard to understand why he doesn't just kill him unless there's some sort of connection that he's aware of that's
he does cock his head. He does cock his head when he says Audrey Horn. He's like, he kind of looks at him differently, and then he hawks and spits and then does the, you know, tricks him because he's, you know, Richard Horn's a sucker. So,
well, that Mr. C's a ninja. I mean, that was quite the move.
Yeah, that was pretty badass. I'm going to have to remember that.
And he didn't smash his face when he punched him, so that's good.
Yep. And yeah, and just the fact that he didn't kill him. And he said, like, get in the car or get in the truck. We'll talk about it on the way. On the way to where? Twin Peaks, I guess?
Yeah, better have some Cheetos for that ride.
Yeah. Some burgers, maybe. Some ketchup.
Yeah, as has already been mentioned, that we see him send that text to Diane. How are you feeling on that island over there? Are you getting
I'm still into the firm on it. No, nope. I am firmly on land. I can't leave my people now. No. Not until they tell me she's evil. I am mayor, governor of this island. I still don't believe it. I still don't believe it. Because here's the thing, right? Timeline issues on this, because she's already gotten the text from somebody else. So
that's if this is going linear.
I know, but it's rare for me to bring up this, but it's possible that he's sending it to his two goons that are killing people in Vegas, because that's where we go to shit soon. So, like, if y'all killed everybody in Vegas, but instead of incriminating himself, he just puts Vegas. Just because she gets almost the exact same text, or maybe the exact same text, doesn't incriminate her, because if the glove don't fit, you can't commit.
And we do still have the person who's masquerading as Philip Jeffries out there, which was pretty much talked about, sort of, because he asked him if you called me, and he says, I don't have your number, so that means somebody else has his number if this Philip Jeffries wasn't lying.
Another thing we have to consider, too, is that Diane didn't get a text message that said Las Vegas with a question mark.
Yes, she did.
I thought it said, did they mention Las Vegas? Or have they talked about
it? It was Las Vegas with a question mark. Mm-hmm. She writes back, they haven't asked yet.
Yeah. Oh, okay. All
right. Yeah, M's right. I can't give up on her yet.
But I like the idea of him texting Hutch and Chantel, you know, Las Vegas. Like, did you do it yet?
Yeah.
You know,
I need you somewhere else soon.
Or like, are you there yet? Kind of like just a real quick, because he's probably not going to be real communicative on the text message. Like, hey, what's up, guys? How's it going? LOL.
They haven't even texted him back to tell him that they killed the warden yet either.
Yeah, that's true.
So I don't know. I can't give up on her. I'm still there. I know. I'm a sucker.
Well, the jury's still out. I mean, I feel like it's one of those Judy kind of situations at this point, you know?
Yeah, I might lose people, but I was alone by myself at the beginning.
Just if it starts to get too low, just make everybody drink the Kool-Aid and make it the Jim Jones Island.
The Sunny Jim Jones.
The Sunny Jim Jones.
Jim Jones.
So as they pull away, the convenience store glitches out of this time space.
So cool.
Now, do you think it was only materialized as it, you know, where it was in the first place to be there for Mr. C to go? Or do you think this is symbolic of something larger happening, like all of the like forces moving towards an inevitable end of the story?
Well, I took it's
disappearance.
When they're driving in, when he's driving in initially, and they show the power lines and the electricity, it's kind of like maybe he was summoning it with some of his powers. Like, okay, I'm driving down this road, there's nobody around, let me go ahead and I mean, we know he has some form of power with electricity because of what happened at the prison that he was sending. They show us that intentionally to kind of send it. Now, we don't know until it's gone, but that would make sense that certain beings can call forth the convenience store. You know what I mean? And then it's the gate to go all to all these other places.
He started thinking about this, or started getting it moving, and then it moved through the power lines.
Yeah.
And then it made the convenience store materialize where he needed it to be. And then,
like, Bob, if he still has Bob inside of him, possibly Bob should be able to call it, because technically he came from the same place that the Woodsman did.
He used to live above it.
Yeah.
With Mike.
Mm-hmm.
In that place.
That's the way I took it, that he can call it, certain people can call it like maybe certain times or whatever. I don't know.
I like that idea. I like the idea that it materializes when it's necessary for the people who can call it, and then it goes out of existence. Because if they leave it there in a single physical spot, somebody is eventually going to buy that land and just bulldoze over it.
Or walk up those stairs and go into the...
Right,
into the bad place.
Very bad.
Because everywhere else seems to be doors.
Or does it not move? Did he have to drive all the way to New Mexico to go up into there?
Well, no, that's a great... See, that supports the point, because he was driving from... Richard Horn followed him from the Thug Farm in Montana. Mm-hmm. And we already know he was heading west, because he's going towards the coordinates, which are in Twin Peaks, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So And that looked very wooded, more wooded than any place in Arizona probably has any right to be looking like.
Maybe that's one of the criteria. Like, you have to go into the woods. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. It just seemed that way because of the electricity.
Next scene, we have Garrison and Steven in the woods. And this is a really, really intense scene. A lot of it has to do with the sound, which I thought was amazing. But it was so fraught with alarming doom, I guess, would be the best way to describe that. Garrison and Steven are sitting up next to a very large tree. We've got some things to actually speculate on that Steven says here, such as, no, she did it. No, I did it. Obviously, this has got to be about Becky.
That was my first thought. And at first I had thought because he had the gun that maybe he killed her. Like, they got into some crazy argument and this is the gun that she had that she had pulled out from under the couch, you know, and went to go shoot up Garrison's apartment. And then, you know, they got back together like all these couples usually do. You know, they fight and then they get back together, et cetera, et cetera. So then he takes that gun. They have an argument. He takes the gun and he kills her. Somehow, like, he's trying to take it away from her, maybe. But after a couple of watches, I started to think that maybe, because he's obviously altered at this point. He's high as hell on something, and she even makes mention of that. Like, you're just stoned, you know? She did this. Like, I think maybe she went and got some sparkle or something like that and gave it to them, and they got high together, and then he freaked out, and she had an overdose, possibly, and then he just ran.
Well, it's interesting that he's rubbing his leg. It made me think of Jerry Horn being high out in the woods and looking at his leg. So maybe nothing happened also. But I like the idea, because I thought that he had killed her too, but I like the idea that maybe she OD'd and he ran and called her. That's really cool. That's really cool. I just thought of Jerry with the whole leg thing, and then the way that the trees are portrayed in this scene. They're like the extra actor in it, you know?
Well, yeah, just watching them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he also says to Garrison, are you going to come up with me? And she says, no, and neither are you. And then he says later, when I see you come up, I may not see you. I bring that up because after she hears the gunshot later on and she has her moment of wigging out where she's like rubbing her hand all over her, like she's trying to erase herself out of existence to not deal with what just happened around the tree. She looks upward and I'm wondering if she's looking for a vortex. So when he's talking about coming up, I'm thinking he's talking about going up into a vortex. And so maybe whatever's happening with Becky involves something like that. Maybe she went into one and I don't know.
It's possible.
And I think this goes back to the idea that you had put forth about possibly Sparkle being, you said, being drug runned from people from the lodge, where John Bernardi took that idea and talked about Sparkle being as a way to allow people to get into these places.
Or accidentally just got sucked up because he was out in the woods doing it.
Oof.
Because look at Jerry getting high out in the woods, and he has issues, you know. So maybe they got high out in the woods and shit just got fucked up quick, you know, like got real on him.
After he says, I may not see you. And then he says, where will I be? Will I be with the rhinoceros? And we had the girl who was high at the roadhouse that had the itchy armpit talking about a freaking penguin. And wasn't there another animal?
There was another couple of animals. Yeah, and, that they mentioned.
So
giraffe, I think.
And then he mentions how would he be a lightning in the bottle?
And then something about turquoise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which it all sounds like gibberish, really. But like just the rantings of somebody who is high on something. But with the animal being mentioned and then the other animals being mentioned, which good call, because I didn't think of that. That didn't even pop into my head.
And the lightning in the bottle is electricity.
Huh.
You know, it's...
Yeah, it's that fire that Hawk was talking about that is utilized. And it depends with the intent behind it, how it's used.
And then his leg's giving him issues. So, I mean, who knows?
Maybe it's going numb. The leg could have been going numb. I mean, I know that usually happens to the arms.
So I was wrong about the nature of their relationship. They were definitely fucking.
Oh, yeah.
So Garrison, I wonder if she was his high school teacher. Maybe that's why she was just like, oh, no. He starts saying, I'm a high school graduate. It just brought back that connection that she wants to ignore.
I don't know. It was weird, especially when that guy comes and then she runs. Well, the guy comes around the corner. Not what it sounded like. Sorry.
He shows up.
Yeah, he shows up and then she runs.
That's why I think she's his high school teacher. She doesn't want to be seen with him in an embrace.
That's a good point.
At this point, Steve's got to be in his 20s. So I'm not worried about the age difference. This has never bothered me. And I'm more focused on it's kind of like you ever seen Arrested Development, and you know Tobias is an anal rapist,
yeah.
You know, but it says anal rapist if you pronounce it. He's yes. like, he goes, that's not how it's pronounced. He's like, I'm not worried how it's pronounced. You know, it's like the word. I'm more concerned about the fact that she's with this dirtbag. This is just, he's disgusting. The guy who plays him did an excellent job in portraying yeah. just a really greasy, nasty character that you just never want to be around. That's the thing that gets me. The age difference kind of comes in, the age difference kind of comes in a second place to that. Because mm-hmm. I'm just like, why would anybody want to do that? You know?
Yeah, I agree.
But
well, they also, I think she also runs and he freaks out because he's holding a gun. And Mark Frost is playing that guy that comes around the corner.
Oh, awesome.
Reprising his role as Cyril Pons, which he played in the original series where he was a news reporter.
Very cool.
So do you guys think that Steven killed himself?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I do, because Cyril Pons had, we see him talking to Carl, so we know he didn't get shot.
Mm-hmm.
We know that Gersten didn't get shot, so
Jerry could have.
Yeah, he could have seen Jerry and he could have shot him. What are you doing? But so that just leaves Steve, really, mm-hmm. unless he just decided to discharge the weapon for no reason, you know, either up in the sky or at a tree or at the ground. But
yeah.
I don't think that's it. I think he did himself in.
And if people discharge a weapon out of like fear or anger, they pull the trigger a few times. It's never just once. It's usually like two or three.
Well, mm-hmm. he only put one bullet in there, right?
It looked like there was already some mm-hmm. in there, oh, and he was putting more on top.
Yeah.
He was loading the 9mm.
So, and plus, we would have heard something if he had shot somebody else, maybe even him screaming in fear because he had just killed somebody. There was silence, completely silence.
Mm-hmm. It almost seems like he would say something to her. He'd be like, I'm all right. I'm okay. Yeah. False alarm.
Oops.
Yeah.
So at Fat Trout Trailer Park, Cyril Pons walks up to Carl Rod and he gestures towards Steven's trailer saying that he lives there, reporting what he saw in the woods. So now we're at the Roadhouse. The MC announces one of his favorite songs, which is Sharp Dressed Man by ZZ Top. And he sends it way over 10. I mean, even past 11.
He's gone plaid.
Yeah, plaid. Did you guys notice the pine cone attached to the end of the microphone?
Yeah, that's been there before.
Oh, it has been there before? I think that's the first time I've noticed that.
No, I missed it completely.
I guess I'm just always looking at the MC because he's, mm-hmm. he's such a character.
He's a sharp-dressed man.
He is.
So Jimmy and Freddie are on the scene, and Jimmy as in James, and James walks up to say hi, Renee, in this really awkward way. Like, I don't know what the deal is with James.
Yeah, not, hi guys, how are y'all doing? Oh, hey, Renee. No. Hey, Renee, I think I like you. You know, something weird like that. Just, I would get mad too. Like, come on, because you know he's done this before.
Yeah, he's probably got wind of James's attraction towards Renee. And this enrages Renee's husband, and he attacks James immediately, as well as his friend. And Freddie steps in. And he just taps both of the men right in the face and turns them into vegetables pretty much immediately.
Now, did you guys notice that he hit them so hard that when they hit the ground, sometime between him making contact with their face and them hitting the ground, the song Sharp Dressed Man by ZZ Top skips?
Oh, no, I missed that.
That they do it. I don't know if it's an electricity thing or if it's like they're hitting the ground so hard that it makes the CD skip thing.
Maybe that's why they chose to have a song that's played by a CD rather than actually having a band, so they could get that effect.
Mm-hmm,
that's a good point. Yeah. That's a good point, because they wouldn't have been able to do that unless they had like made some big, big show out of it where the power just blipped out and then came back. Because this is a little bit more subtle, because I don't know if everybody noticed it. So I thought that was,
you know, him. And I was glad his friend stepped in, because, you know, he didn't deserve to get his ass beat like that. You know, he could have been handled a different way. And then his friend start kicking him while he was obviously getting his ass whipped already was just dirty. So, hey,
they deserved it.
Yeah.
They shouldn't have been beaten. He's not even fighting back. He's on the ground with his fists up, trying not to, you know, get hurt
now,
as much as possible.
Did he have to use the Hulk glove? No. He could have kicked them both. Neither of them were looking at him, but for effect. Okay. Smash him. I get it.
he's a better kid than me, because I just would have taken a full swing. Right. I'm like, back up. Wow.
And then run up and kick him. Maybe don't kill anybody.
You know, and the way to handle James doesn't seem like it had to be that harsh. You know, you could have.
Yeah.
Everybody knows how James is. He's like, seems to be like a little bit of a not quite there as much James as he was in the original series. So
yeah,
you could just walk up to him and put your arm around him and be like, hey, listen, I know you think my wife's nice. I do too. That's why I married her. But just when we're here together at the Roadhouse trying to have a drink with our friends, just don't talk to her. Yeah, if you see her at the store, say hi. That's it. You know,
like, don't
like
be
that
creep.
Kind of violence was just over the top.
Yeah, I agree completely.
So James yells for someone to call 911 and he apologized. Apologizes to Renee, and she does not look receptive.
No. My husband is foaming at the mouth.
Not good. So it looks like Renee's going to have a Leo on her hands that she's going to have to take care of. Will James step in like Bobby and help out?
No,
no.
Not that Bobby was much of a help.
Not that she would want the guy to put him like that to help. You know, don't care how bad the song is.
James has his hand full just, you know, hanging out with Jimmy and drinking at the Roadhouse after his shift as a security guard at the Great Northern. And maybe he goes back to his studio apartment and just kind of, you know, stares at the wall.
Sings.
Maybe writes some poetry. Yeah.
So we have a quick scene at the Las Vegas FBI headquarters with Wilson telling Agent Randall Headley that Douglas Jones and his wife are present with their kids.
Kids,
plural. Oh, I love that. This whole episode is a roller coaster.
Mm-hmm.
Some really great laugh out loud moments and some moments that just make you happy and then some moments that make you really sad. So next we have Duncan Todd and he calls in Roger. He wants to know if he's heard anything from Anthony Sinclair. Chantal comes in and takes them both out. She shoots Duncan Todd in the head, shoots Roger in the chest. As she's walking out, ordering her fries with Hutch, she hears that Roger is still trying to breathe through a gaping hole in his chest, it sounds like. And so she walks back in to finish off the job. And one down, one more to go.
And she has a conversation with Hutch on the way out about what fast food they're going to be eating. And she reminds him to get ketchup, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, it's ketchup.
So who's the one more to go? Dougie?
Gotta be, right?
Mm-hmm.
Either that or his name at the insurance agency?
Anthony Sinclair.
Mm-hmm.
Would they know about Anthony Sinclair? Because it was Duncan Todd who hired Anthony Sinclair. Did that information go up to Mr. C?
I mean, if he's running a business, you would think.
But that was Duncan Todd doing... because. Out of desperation.
Yeah, it's but possible. They had been running deals for a while, though, because of everything that was going on at the insurance company. That was his man. So if they're making money, he might know. I think it's Dougie. I mean, it just makes sense that he would know about Dougie Coop.
It could be Sinclair, because you're right. He told Bushnell that he had been working for him for a while, you know, doing crooked shit and everything like that. And the last conversation that Duncan Todd and Mr. C had was being like, don't make me call you again. Make sure this gets taken care of. So I think he was aware of how the shit was rolling downhill at that point. And so the job got handed to Anthony Sinclair, who was unable to give the poison to Dougie a few parts ago. And then,
or he was just going to take him out anyway. Like, he took out the warden, even though the warden honored his
end of the bargain.
Yeah.
Except the warden didn't try to track them, though. And so maybe that's why he decided to have the warden killed, because of the tracking on the phone.
Yeah.
Do you think he would have still had the warden killed?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think he would have had the warden killed because of things he knew about him. Maybe conversations, you know, why? And to send a message also there's so many boxes you can check off with killing a warden like that. Don't track me. You know, don't try and capture me. Don't be a dick.
Could have had something to do with the fact that Ray had a gun when he probably shouldn't have had a gun.
So he felt
so
set up.
Yeah, he probably put two and two together at that point, and he was like,
yeah, that's more likely.
Yeah,
right.
That's why good.
He knows it was Philip Jeffries that was
setting everything.
Yeah.
So
we have a quick scene where James and Freddie are being placed in their cells. Hawk actually puts James in his cell, and Bobby puts Freddie in his. And both Steve and I were hoping that Bobby and James would say something to each other, but nothing was said.
Because presumably, now I don't want to assume too much, because Chad's definitely not a bookhouse boy.
Yeah.
But presumably, James... or Bobby could be a bookhouse boy at this point, now that he's come over to the good side. He's part of the force. Him and James have probably made up long since. mm-hmm. you know, hopefully. And, you know, and they've gone and had coffee together or whatever and stuff. So, yeah, I was hoping for this little scene between them that I didn't get. But the bigger question here is, why is James under arrest in the first place? We don't have to spend too much time on it, but he was assaulted by two people. Then somebody he was with hit those two guys in the face. James didn't do anything wrong.
Yeah, but if, so, you know, if she's like, well, he came over here and started shit and then they got into a fight and his friend killed him, they would just take both until they figured out who started the fight or what. You know, it's kind of like a group thing. Like, okay, you kind of instigated this, even though you're just saying hello to this guy's wife and they kicked your ass. But if his wife, Renee and them said, oh, they started it and caused this problem, put them in jail.
Okay, I see. So it's kind of like when you get busted when you're a kid mm-hmm. and your mom pulls everybody and says, like, I don't care who did what. We're going to figure all this out later. But until then, you're all going to your room.
Exactly.
Yeah, you know, kind of thing.
Exactly.
James just has a history for falling in love with women who are spoken for and for being arrested for things he didn't do.
Right.
Rinse and repeat.
Yeah. Yeah, it would have been great, though, for Bobby to just walk by. If they're not friends, look at James and be like, have a nice night in the cell, easy rider.
James is startled by NATO. And she begins to chatter at him. She's like kind of gesturing towards him with her mm-hmm. hand. So I'm wondering if something's going to...
She like, sees some sort of something in
yeah, the, like, she James. Knows. Because he's supposed to be significant for some reason. Mm-hmm. So I'm still waiting for this significance. So maybe it has to do with NATO. Mm-hmm.
She could be gesturing towards Freddie, though, because mm-hmm. he has the glove.
But James is directly in front of her.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, you're right.
And Billy imitates NATO, as we see. Or we're calling him Billy. I don't know if it's Billy, but I'm just going to call him Billy for expediency. And Chad yells, shut up!
Oh, the funniest part, though, is that is funny. That gets me every time. But I still think the funniest part in this episode is when, I don't know if it's when Jeffrey says, I'll write it down for you. I don't know why that's funny, but it is. Or when they come in and Hawk says, shut up, Chad. And then Billy's all like, shut up, Chad.
Shut up. I know, like off in the background, you hear like, shut up, Chad. I'm kind of, you know, I'm worried about the police department when they think it's okay for that guy to be in that kind of condition.
Yeah.
You know?
He needs medical attention, like insane asylum medical attention.
Or at least a medic.
Yeah.
You know, this guy might have eaten, drinking some motor oil, like M said. You know, it's,
ugh.
They should have him like patched up a little bit. Like, don't get hurt and go to jail in Twin Peaks because they might not call an ambulance.
Yeah, you're going to be that way for the rest of the night in a cell next to Chad.
And a girl with a weird face, you know, like no eyeballs or whatever. You know, it's like, fuck.
So we have a quick scene between Hutch and Chantal. They're eating their dinner in their vehicle, and they talk about how the government kills just like them, except the government are hypocrites because they try to act like they do good. And Chantal is aching to torture, which I think we need to be worried about. Mm-hmm. People we care about because of this. And Hutch says, nice night, which all there is just one star, which it's not. It's actually a planet. It's Mars, because she points out that it's Mars in the sky. But it really is not a remarkable looking night. So it's funny that he says, nice night.
Yeah, it's extremely run of the mill.
All about perspective.
Of course, this scene did make me want to go get burgers and fries, just greasy fast food.
Not me. I don't know. When Chantal's eating, the last thing I want to do is eat.
It made me hungry. I don't know. It's just like, I was like, man, that looks good. And burger and fries looks good right now.
Yeah, and she's all like, did you give me dessert? I love you. Here's your Pop Pocket.
Like, I can smell the grease from...
Oh yeah,
I know. Smell fried grease,
and it makes me hungry. I mean, I'm a fast food junkie, but you know, so I guess it's a trigger, is what it is.
I got
triggered. So
now we're back with Janie E and Dougie, and Janie E gives Dougie some more of Sunny Jim's birthday cake, or they just have cake delivered, like people used to have milk delivered at their doorstep. I don't know.
Right?
No, I'm telling you, she knows how to do three things. Culinary-wise, besides breakfast and coffee and stuff like that. Chocolate cake, sandwiches, and potato chips. That's what she feeds this guy. That's why he was, you know, a little on the heavy side before when he was Dougie.
Yeah.
When he really was Dougie.
Well, it's also why it just seems unreal.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I do love that lamp on their table, though. I don't know why I keep bringing it up, but it's pretty cool.
It's like a half globe, half golden globe, which makes me think of Laura.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a good point. It's a good point that you brought it up before.
And, oh, Dougie, she says, it is like all our dreams are coming true. I don't think that line's in there for no reason.
Dreams coming true.
And so she leaves him there to eat his cake by himself. After a couple of tries, he succeeds turning on the TV because he pressed like random buttons on the remote. And what do we have but Sunset Boulevard, David Lynch's favorite movie, on the television screen. And we get to a point where a character says, "Get Gordon Cole." And this startles him, triggers a memory maybe. And he pauses the screen. Whatever new awareness he has achieved because of this line in this movie has allowed him to be aware of an electrical humming that's coming from the light socket. So he starts to crawl towards it with fork in hand. And you know what's going to happen.
Oh, yeah.
Because he is like a child. He tries to get the prongs in first, and then he turns it around to the other side, and it fits perfectly and gets a big jolt. Janie E screams from the kitchen and it fades to black. Sunny Jim says from upstairs, "Mom, what was that?" Now, when Janie E screams, that's Naomi Watts screaming, and it sounds so much like the scream in Mulholland Drive that happens right when you go from one reality to another, one unreality to a reality, or whatever you want to call it.
All right, so show of hands. Next episode, do we have Cooper?
Yes.
Dale Cooper. Agent I think Dale so. Cooper.
Maybe they send his personality and memories through the electricity into him, like Frankenstein. Hmm.
So why did it take all this for that to happen? I mean,
because David Lynch wanted to make us wait.
Yeah, pain and suffering. That's why.
Garmin Bosia. We had to eat our share of Garmin Bosia to get the awesomeness that's coming at the end.
Yeah, because Dougie's not going to be able to fumble his way through the two killers that are on their way. There's no way.
That's a good point.
Mm-mm.
Yeah, Ike the Spike was one thing, and you know that was orchestrated well. Mm-hmm. But two people
who are heartless.
Yeah.
So you don't think that he's gone back through the light socket and is traveling and leaving Janie E and Sunny Jim behind? I don't know. I'm just putting that out there. I haven't actually.
That's a great idea. Though.
Landed on that.
I didn't even think of that. He could go back through. And then end up in Twin Peaks.
But see, he entered a body when he came through the light socket. So would he have to leave a body behind
and
enter into Mr. C?
I have no idea. I hope not, because Janie E and them are dead meat if he's not there to protect them.
Unless they're going after somebody else. And it's Chantel and Hutch are kind of in a way a red herring to make us think they're going after Dougie. Mm-hmm. So we expect him to stay with Janie E.
Yeah, and that would be really frustrating if Gordon Cole and them show up at Janie E's house to talk to possibly Dougie, but he's been sucked in, like in one of those old movies where, I'll walk away when the other people show up.
Yeah.
That would be frustrating. Yes. That would be super totally frustrating. You know, it'd be like,
I could totally see it, though. I want to see a battle between the two coops, though. So if he was sucked in, it would kind of indicate that he's going to come back out into the other body, like M said, which would be Mr. C's body somewhere in Twin Peaks. And then that would eliminate the whole process of a fight, because then he could just try to assert his dominance and one gets shoved back into the lodge.
Yeah, but Mr. Presumably. C's going to win if he still has Bob in him, though.
That's true. But even if he doesn't at this point. If he doesn't have Bob in him, he hasn't had Bob in him since he got shot, and he was still able to do superhuman stuff to Resno. So,
and walk Renzo. Down the road with a bullet in him.
Yeah, and so that's still trouble.
Bob and or no Bob. I think he might still have Bob, because even the woodsmen were just cool with him. You know, if he didn't have Bob, would the woodsmen be cool with him and taking orders?
Yeah, they might be like, "You're not the boss of me."
They seemed like they disdained him to me.
Yeah, but that's the way they look at everybody.
Yeah. They're lazy by nature. They were just resentful of being asked to do anything.
Yeah, you know why that wallpaper was dirty? It's because those guys are always walking by and like touching it with their hands. Just wash them.
Like, if you ask these woodsmen to do anything besides grow beards and stay dirty, they just get all pissy worked about up. It.
Yeah.
You know? Oh, man, somebody wants to go see Jeffries again.
Oh. So we're now to a very sad scene with Margaret calling Hawk to tell him that she is dying. There's some interesting things that she says to him here, such as, "Watch for that one, the one under the moon on Blue Pine Mountain." She says, "My log is turning gold. The wind is moaning. I'm dying." The thing I focus on the most here is her saying that her log is turning gold. There's been so much gold in this series. And we just had Nadine walking to see Ed carrying her golden shovel. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if gold is Twin Peaks ossifying. It's like when you close the book of a like an old book and it's got the gold leaf around the pages.
Oh, yeah. The edges.
Mm-hmm. This is we're closing chapters here. We're seeing the end, and yeah. And it's going to be in some cases gilded.
It's sad, but it fits. I like it.
Yeah, I
like
know.
It in a it's really sad good. Way. Like it's like it makes sense as you're saying it, even though I don't want it to be true. But you know it's going to be true, so it doesn't really matter what mm-hmm. you want or what you like.
Try to connect gold to wood, gold to death, and I couldn't find anything that seemed meaningful to me.
Yeah.
So watch for that one, the one under the moon on Blue Pine Mountain. Do you think that this is referencing a doorway that's supposed to open up? Is this like the area of the coordinates? Does this have to do with Cooper?
It struck me as having something to do with the coordinates. Oh. That's my gut feeling on that, but mm-hmm. it's so vague and it's so could be anywhere. There's a lot of that in this episode. Mm-hmm. For as much as it gave us in terms of things that are happening in a sense of finality, you know, Ed and Nadine not being together, Ed yeah. and Norma being together, what happened with Cooper and Jeffries. You know, that's where you start to get like the, well, wait a minute, could it be this? Could it be that? And then you still have a lot of finality in the scene with Margaret dying. But at the same time, all of these cryptic hints that she leaves. And she even tells Hawk, like, some of this stuff we talked about face-to-face when you were here, but we can't talk about it on the phone. So that just cuts the audience mm-hmm. out of it automatically because it's a conversation we weren't privy to. So we have to try to fill in the blanks. And when you hear about the one and the Blue Pine Mountain, I think of portals, I think of coordinates, I think of climactic endings, and I know that's kind of nebulous in itself, but that's what it makes me think of.
So nice. Maybe Cooper is traveling and he's going to be coming out of that portal.
Yeah.
And then we're going to have the boxing match right there on Blue Pine Mountain.
Sweet. I thought it was
under the moonlight,
but I mean, it's the easiest answer to come to, you know, like when she says that one, it's pretty specific, you know what I mean? Like watch that one and yeah. like they're going to come across Coop. Evil. They might not come across any Coop, but the first one they've come across might be in that area. Wait,
did she say watch for that one?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Philip Jeffries' amended speech is who do you think that is there, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Instead yeah. of who do you think this is there? Mm-hmm. So there we go. That's the key to it.
She's telling Hawk it's going to be the one under the moon on Blue Pine Mountain. So maybe Mr. C will be the one under the moon on Blue Pine Mountain. He'll know that that's not the right one.
Right. Because, you know, we can make, you know, we get the obvious go-to joke is, well, you can look at the haircut. You can look at the dress.
Yeah,
but none of these people have seen Dale Cooper in any of his incarnations for 25 years. Like, it's a good point because for us as the viewer, they look completely different. They look like they're almost being played by two different actors mm-hmm. at times. But for the people in Twin Peaks, Mr. C could show up and pass himself off as Dale Cooper.
Yeah.
And who would know? Mm-hmm.
You know, it already walked
because he actually did that Horn. Already when he left town, you know, because mm-hmm. he came back. He was the one who came out. And then they were like, well, you know, he went to go visit Major Briggs and then, you know, everything else. So, yeah.
And Audrey's sons already thought he was Coop. Just by seeing him.
Yeah, yeah.
That's true. And it's the scene ends with her saying goodnight, Hawk, and he says goodnight, Margaret. And it just gives you this huge impression, this impression that death is so lonely,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it was just so sad for her. And then knowing that Catherine Coulson died during the production of this, it was a nice way to send off the character.
Yeah.
In a very respectful way, especially later when Hawk reports it to everybody else at the station, which is the next scene here. He actually does it in the conference room. He tells Andy, Lucy, Bobby, and Sheriff Truman. They lower their heads and cry. And we see her cabin in the night and the lights fade to black.
Yeah, it was really classy. It was a mm-hmm. real nice way to do that.
And, I agree.
The first time watching this episode during our pre-episode ritual, I had maybe a little bit more whiskey than usual, than I usually have. So I was, you know, I was fist pumping the air whenever Ed and Norma finally got together. And then at this part, you know, the waterworks started. So it was kind of like the emotions got elicited out of me at an even greater rate than they normally would have. So
yeah,
rewatches were definitely a necessity on this one because I missed a few things the first time I watched it because you're just awash and all of this stuff, like the good stuff and then the payment for it.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're with Audrey and Charlie again. And Audrey just gets in her own way, which is really evident right here. Charlie's willing to walk out of the house, got his coat on and everything. But Audrey keeps arguing in circles here.
What I thought was interesting about this scene is it feels like the ideas that have been put forth by people saying that this is he's her doctor and this is therapy, and they're role playing, and he's trying to get her to get a breakthrough, to actually gain some self-starting momentum and get out of the house, and she's just not getting to it. She won't do it. He's trying to, and he's getting to the point where he's using bad language with her and everything, you know, and giving it right back to her. Because when it starts off a few parts back, he's very controlled and calm and measured, and he lets her kind of rant and rave and rage. And then you kind of, the next time he's a little bit more assertive, and now this time he's like, I've got my fucking coat, but if you don't walk out this door, I'm going to go sit down right now. And then he finally does it, but he's not getting the breakthrough out of her that he wants. She actually probably is snaps. Reverting back to a earlier stage, and she jumps on him and is attacking him and saying how she hates him and everything like that. So he almost was successful. That's the lens through which I'm viewing this scene. I don't know if it's completely accurate to do so, but that's where I ended up.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I mean, but it's a little frustrating. Like, I'm getting a little, I want to say tired of the extension of this scene. I want a little something more out of her. Like, right. I want her ass to get out and go to the roadhouse, you know, anything. I just want to see some resolution to all of her scenes. I want more from Audrey. That's all.
Or maybe to have her, to have Audrey Horne interact with another character outside of Charlie, you know, outside of that room.
Yeah.
So you've given her to us now in three consecutive parts, which basically amounts to the same thing. They just get closer to the door every time. And now this time they're at the threshold and they don't pass over it. And so we're just still not there. So in some ways, I guess you could look at it as this is how we are with Dougie. You know, we keep getting closer and closer to the door, but do we go through it? Nope. Right. We just go over to the side, you know, or like over on the couch.
And some kind of resolution is going to have to come because she's choking him.
Yeah. Yeah. So the next episode, there has to be something.
Yeah.
Well, I think she is her own gatekeeper. She's getting in her own way. Mm-hmm. He might be a figment of her imagination.
Yeah.
Her overcoming what's keeping her trapped, which is herself, is the key to something else. Because I keep getting this sense of her being trapped, that I feel trapped also when I watch it. So I think it's actually been well done. And probably the next time we see her, we're going to get a breakthrough.
I hope so.
I mean, we don't really have much time left anyway.
I know, right?
Yeah, the whole thing strikes me as weird. Not off or bad in any way like that, but weird. And not just in the normal, like, David Lynch sense, like, oh, it's weird. It's I'm not sure what's going on. I could go with the figment of the imagination thing just as well as I could with her being her doctor. Because something has got to be there. But I feel like you have a character that was so, I don't want to say integral to the original, but it was so prominent in certain parts of the original series, brought back in late innings and used to minimal effect up till now. And it seems weird. And I want to see her interact with other people, because then it would prove some things, that she's not trapped in a coma, that she's able to actually get out of this physical location and do these other things, because we don't know if any of that's true or not. So
now we're back at the roadhouse, and we have the Vales playing a song called Axolotl, which is not the same word as axolotl, because axolotl from Dune, the axolotl tanks, is different. Axolotl is a what they're singing about is a salamander from Mexico. We have a character named Ruby that's sitting in the Frank booth, and she tells these guys who want her seat that she is waiting for someone, and they forcibly remove her, put her onto the floor. She begins to crawl into the crowd, and eventually she begins to scream, and that's how we end this episode.
It was weird for me because those guys pick her up and put her on the ground and she starts crawling, right? And it seems like no one's paying any attention to her. So I felt like maybe she was being pulled somewhere, and that's why she screams, because she's in like a haze, and maybe she's on Sparkle, like you said earlier, and she's getting sucked into a gate or something, because nobody pays any attention to her. And then when you watch the credits, did you guys watch the credits all the way through?
Right. Yeah.
And then there's the bosomed woman standing there at the very end in the courtyard. It's like, well, maybe they're sucking people in there too. I don't know. It was just really odd that no one was even like, you know, if I was standing at a concert and I loved the music, it might have been my favorite song. I don't know why. I just really liked it. And she's crawling by, like, hey, do you need some help? You know, it's not normal to be crawling on the floor because, first of all, ew, you know, it's going to be disgusting. It's going to be dirty. Yeah. And I wouldn't want anybody to get stepped on or trampled because the place was pretty packed. So I felt like she was kind of almost being sucked into something. I don't know.
Yeah, plus it used to be that in the Roadhouse that if you saw bikers in there, they were bookhouse boys. Mm-hmm. And these guys were dressed like bikers. They did not behave like bookhouse boys.
No, uh-uh.
We haven't seen any bookhouse boys.
That's kind of sad. We haven't even had them mentioned.
Mm-mm. So you have that protective element of the town that's just completely missing.
Yeah.
I like your idea, Paul, about how she could have been, you know, because nobody is paying attention to her. Yeah. So, no. Like, what the hell's going on? If she gets sucked up into a vortex and then she ends up at, I don't know if we can call it the Dutchman, if we know that for sure, but let's just, you know, what we're talking about when we say that, you know, and then you see the bosomy woman standing there and then it's like, oh, shit, that's where she ends up.
That place is almost different because, I mean, granted, the vortex we saw go to the stairs, but he walks through a door. So maybe it's kind of like the Black Lodge where there's just like a little gateway that Sparkle opens up that you can just walk through. It's possible.
And then the bookhouse boys, I'm really worried about the bookhouse boys. And I know that not everything that was in Mark Frost's book, The Secret History of Twin Peaks, is necessarily going to show up in the show. But you have the double whammy of it being canon from the first two seasons.
Yeah.
And then you have it in his book. So it's in all or both sources of canon material that you can go to. I mean, I guess obviously they would be there in Fire Walk With Me too, even though you really don't have them as much. But you guys, I mean, have anything to think about that? Like, is it just waiting to spring at the last moment?
I'm hoping. They're all gonna...
It's in all the books. I mean, it's in the Access Guide. It's in Laura's Diary. It's not, I don't think, in My Life, My Tapes.
They've made us wait for everything else. So why not the Bookhouse Boys? Because it's so important, you know? Give us something on the Bookhouse Boys, please.
Yeah, just a little bit. Just to throw us a bone.
All right. Well, you guys could tell us what you think this week if you write into our podcast at noshipnetwork@gmail.com. We will read your feedback. Just have it in by 6 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, and we'll have it up on Friday. Please keep your feedback to about 2 to 3 paragraphs long so we can make sure to read everybody's feedback and to not edit your points.
Don't make us chop it up, is what she's saying. Don't make us do it. All right, so we hope you enjoyed our coverage of part 15 of The Return. Oh, we are perilously close to the end.
I know, it's sad.
Yeah.
So, as Em said, join us in a couple of days so we can hear what you had to say about this great episode. This has been a No Ship Network podcast. I'm your host, Steve.
I'm your host, Paul.
And I am your host, Em.
We mean it like it is.
Like it sounds.
Stay gold, Pony Boy.
Stay gold, Pony Boy.